Welcome to a Bowden Education podcast. This podcast is recorded as part of our In the Spotlight series, where we shine the spotlight on people who have and continue to make a significant and positive contribution to education. Today in the spotlight is David Gumbrell. David has worked in education for many years, and I say that in a lot of experience way rather than you're old, David. And David currently works in initial teacher education at Kingston University. But in addition to this, David has written several books around the topic of resilience for teachers, but also one for children that include Lift, Risk, The Amazing A to Z of Resilience, and Spin. David has also founded the Resilience Project. His work today stems from his wide range of experiences in education and teaching and as a primary head teacher. So welcome, David.
Hi, well, that was some introduction. I hope I can live up to said billing.
I hope so. So today, David, we're going to talk resilience in its widest context.
Okay.
And that's a term that we hear. And I have these little group of terms in my head. You know, it's like celebrity and professionalism and I don't know, there will be others, but certainly those kind of terms that are used so much now that we've kind of utilized them, but not sure we understand what they mean. And I worry that we use terms like that and they lose their meaning, but we use resilience in and around education a lot. How would you define it?
Well, I agree with you that it's sometimes overly used as a phrase, and I think that we've lost an accurate definition of what it is. I think in the early stages, and it still remains the phrase that bounces back at me every time I use the word resilience or talk about word resilience, is that kind of bounce back ability kind of phrase. And it was created by a clever person who was trying to be clever, but actually I'm not sure it tells us the whole story. So bounce back ability for me is a kind of reactive thing that you don't do anything to prepare for it. So it's like going running a marathon and go, oh, look, my legs are achy. How did that happen? You know, bounce back ability for me is a little bit like that. That's kind of reactive after the event and then be surprised by that. But my definition of resilience is much more of a proactive approach that we can top ourselves up in order to have enough to give when life inevitably becomes challenging. And I think we need to recognize that just living and being is hard, and then going into an educational context in a school is just as hard, and that we need to recognize that. So we need to look after ourselves in order to be able to be the teacher that we kind of dream and wanted to be when we first came into teaching. I think my favorite definition at the moment is by, I think, Osho et al. And they say resilience is something around recognizing and then acting upon inner thoughts and feelings. And I really like that, because I think it's a conversation about what's going on in our minds and our brains. And sometimes our brains are wanting to celebrate and we need to celebrate with them. And sometimes our mind is not in a good place and we need to reassure it, and we need to look after it, and we need to find others to help us to do that when we need it. And I think that recognizing the inner signs and signals is one step. But I think what's missing is that acting upon those inner thoughts and feelings. I've got a slide in some of my presentations with the kind of ostrich with their head in the sand. And I think we recognize, I think lots of us now, particularly because of the pandemic, recognize signs and symptoms. But I think we've got a bit of a way to go to actually manage that and deal with those signs and symptoms. So that's a bit of a roundabout way of defining resilience as a proactive approach to looking after yourself, rather than a reactive response to when things go wrong, what are we going to do?
Yeah, and something you hear quite often, isn't it, is the whole notion of resilience as being just get on with it and tough it out. And that really worries me. And that sometimes can come down through leadership circles, that, you know, you just need to tough it out. And that's not about resilience at all. It's like that dialogue, you know, that how can I cope? How can I learn from what I'm going through and help things in the future? I once heard someone talking about exactly that. It's not like the bouncing ball that just bounces back. Think of it more like a slinky spring that moves you forward. So you're learning from things, challenges and situations you've been through, and you learn how to deal with them again in the future. But I really worry about that whole notion that it's just about toughing it out.
I think toughening it out, or I would define as perseverance. And I think perseverance is an element of resilience in the short term. Sometimes we do need to just get through the lesson. Sometimes we just need to get through the week, but it's not a long-term solution. It's a short-term fix, and there will be you have to pay the debt at the weekend as a result of that. So I think that's an important thing for people to consider. I think for me, the slinky spring is a useful metaphor, but for me, the job and life is the kind of pulling factors that are stretching our spring. Mm. And that's a known, and we've got to accept that's the reason why we get paid for what we do at times. But if we've got known forces pulling us apart, what we need to do is put known forces pushing us back together again. And so for me, every day is about, okay, it's going to be a difficult day in terms of the quantity of work that I've got to get through, and therefore the forces of in has got to be even greater to allow me to get through this day. So those are the days where I think I really need to up my exercise. I really need to have a nice meal at the end of the day. I really need to book in that phone call to chat to a friend who thinks I'm the best thing since sliced bread, just to top myself back up again, because I've had so many outward forces. I need to put some inner forces back on it.
And I think that's that proactivity, isn't it? About managing and making sure that you are. I like that idea of topping ourselves back up. And I'm kind of thinking, as a teacher, if you link it to sort of a petrol gauge, quite often, you know, it's your energies are going outward and you can't keep going once you hit the empty. And so you do need to do things that keep you a little bit topped up, things that you enjoy doing, things that are good for yourself, even if you think you're too busy to do that, because that's a common process that lots of people, not just teachers, go through, isn't it? Oh yeah, I know I should go for a run. I know I should go and have a chat with my friend or meet them for a coffee. I'm just too busy with work. I haven't got the time. I need to mark the books and so on. We're very good at making excuses to not top ourselves up, I think.
I agree. And I think there's a difference between if and when. So I did a big talk about the difference between if and when. If I've got time is the phrase that we give ourselves as the opt-out clause. So basically, we're not going to do it because if gives us the option. But when I finish this pile of books, I'm going to go and have a cup of tea. That gives you impetus, that gets you over that inertia, that gives you the reason, it gives you the excuse if you need it. But it is incentivizing that when we have difficult things to do that we don't really want to do. But it gives us that action to go and do it. So I've already made myself a promise at the end of this podcast, I'm going to go and, you know, do something as a result of that, because I would have been sitting down and I would have been looking at the screen. I need to compensate for that. That's fine. I've already put that in with myself, and I've already justified that to myself.
Yeah. And I won't dwell on this because these are data we all know, but there is clearly something still awry within teaching because we are not shifting those attrition figures. So they're really stuck. In fact, I believe that teachers leaving in the first year has slightly gone up, teachers leaving within the first few years has slightly gone down. But overall, the attrition rates are still frighteningly high. And you if you're on Twitter, you'll see quite often teachers saying, I'm moving on, I can't cope anymore. But I'm going to take us back to the beginning and think, back at the beginning of a teacher's career, what do you understand? And you work with lots of student teachers, so those that are just coming, choosing to enter into the profession. What are the key motivators for those people that are coming into the profession?
Well, I do interview quite a few aspiring student teachers, and the most common answer I get is that inspired by their own teachers. So I think there's this lovely notion of kind of a teacher that's made a difference to them, and they want to emulate that themselves. And it generally is, when you ask them about that, it's not they taught well. It's not they did a cracking lesson on semicolons in year four. It's they connected with me. They made me believe in myself. They gave me a sense of belonging. They gave me a sense of aspiration. And I think these are the dreams that we come into teaching wanting to achieve. I think they are aspirational dreams that we come into. I recently read a paper for my master's about, I think it was Perriman and Calvert from the University College London, about motivations of wanting to come into teaching. And they were trying to link that to attrition rates because they are scarily high, as you said. And they were listing wanting to make a difference. That comes up very often. Wanting to work with young people. I've always wanted to work with young people. I get all of that. Loving their subject. So secondary school teachers for certain, loving their subject and wanting to pass on that passion of subject. I think for primary, it's a kind of passion for learning that they want to pass on. I think there's creativity there, or they have an aspiration to want to be creative. And that's certainly what Perriman and Calvert line up. But then I think they certainly found that many of the reasons why we come into teaching aren't actually what teaching is all about. And so what they define as the problem with that is that workload, performativity and accountability, not the stuffing out of that dream for some, not all, for some. And that they don't end up having the variety of work and the creativity and the love of the subject. And the young people might not want to be in love with their subject or in love with learning. And the reality of teaching is it can be difficult at times, and there are demotivated learners and there are pupils having a tough life outside of school. And that somehow bursts that bubble. And I think that when we come in motivated into the profession, we need to consider carefully what's going to maintain that motivation. And I think that it's a gradual shaping between the dream and the reality. Mm. And I believe there's a disconnect between the two. So I remember very vividly when I first approached Kingston University as a head teacher, and I said to them, I took a hose lock with me, you know, those kind of yellow kind of connectors. Yeah. As a metaphor, and I said there's a disconnect between what you produce and what we need. and they were like, well, what was that? And I said, well, they have these wonderful aspirational dreams, and then suddenly, you know, within the first 2 years, because that's when the highest attrition rates kick in, is that that dream is gone, or that dream has been tarnished. What can we do? And it's just checking in on the reality of teaching, and are they coping with that reality? Are they coping with that transition? And many can, and many do, and many will. But I think you need to have that dialogue about these kind of cotton wool, candy floss kind of dreams of being a teacher.
I think it's a really difficult balance, isn't it? Because when you're working with those who are training to teach, I think you. And I've got experience of this as well. And when you lead sessions, you really want to talk about the realities. But at the same time, it's a balance between talking about the realities of the profession and coming across as negative, actually. And it's really difficult to put across that some of these challenges you can overcome, but they are there. And let's not pretend. And sometimes, actually, if we try and ignore the challenges and we don't talk about them openly, that's when they begin to kind of fester and manifest into something that's more and more challenging. I don't know, but I have been in lectures thinking, oh, am I being too negative? Actually, I'm not being negative. I'm saying it as it is.
Yeah, and I think there is a sense of realism that is needed, and a sense of authenticity. So, you know, you look at the DfE adverts for coming into teaching, it's all cotton wool and sweetness and light. And okay, I get that you want to kind of get people into the building, but we're getting lots of people applying to be a teacher, but the attrition rate is 1 in 3 that won't be around in the fifth year of their teaching career. And I keep saying, I'm in my 27th year of my teaching career. and I'm still happy and I'm still contented and I'm still finding value in what I do. And I feel that I've still got something to give and I've still got energy. How am I achieved that and yet others can't? And I think it's something around authenticity and reality.
And so data suggests that if we say that the reality or these people's motivations are challenged, or they're challenging their resilience, the reality challenges resilience compared to that kind of disconnect, as you say, data implies it's early on. Would you agree that teachers are most susceptible to kind of having their resilience challenged early on in their career?
The data backs that considerably. So year one, two, I think it's settling into a new place of work. Partly, I think that there's a danger, and it, again, it's leading back to my master's research about the we have formal mentor connected to us. And therefore, the rest of the school think that it's only the formal mentor that can help and support that teacher because they have the formal role. But like it says, takes a village to raise a child. I think it takes a school to raise a teacher, a new teacher. And we all got to work on a sense of belonging, a sense of settling, a sense of psychological safety, a sense of support. But I don't think we've got that. I think we've got this weird notion that it's one person's role and responsibility to bring them into that school. So they're inevitably vulnerable at that point. And I'm not convinced that the early career framework, despite having high aspirations to make the difference, is what people need. I don't think it offers reassurance. I think it offers intellectual challenge. I think it offers them things to do, but I'm not sure that it offers them a sense of belonging in their context, in their school. And I'm not sure it offers them a sense of reassurance that what they're doing is good enough in the circumstances that they find themselves in.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a lot of self-doubt and there's so much to take on board. So it's not just about the teaching and all the pressures of teaching. It's joining a new community in the school that you join as an early career teacher. And I was actually just thinking about the early career framework and what can we do to support. So the early career framework is a very clear guidance on a two-year support and then engagement and development that our early career teachers are entitled to. So there's an entitlement. That's quite mechanistic, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's too mechanistic in my view. And I believe that it needs to have a softer edge. I think we need to recognize the human being that's trying to be the teacher. And I don't think that document does that enough. And I think that we're still going to see attrition rates that are significant. And I don't believe it's completely connected to COVID. I think that we're not hitting the right nail. We're just hitting a nail very hard, but it's the wrong one. I think what we need to do is we need to recognise the demands of the job and nurture and help and support those going through that transitional process, not in a formal way, but in an informal way. So one SKIP program that I work with proactively offer their students time with me to just check in. Yeah. What they're currently worried about, what's currently going on, what's going well, what's not going well. And as a result of that checking in, the attrition rates are so much better as a result of that, because it's dealing with the doubts and it's managing those doubts and it's reassuring people that the effort they're putting in is worthwhile.
That would form a really interesting study to get attrition data. And I know it would obviously not be the same cohort, but attrition data, typically average attrition data of those trainees, and indeed you could replicate this in schools, but then add in some kind of coaching, mentoring, supervision, provision to allow staff to have that confidential one-to-one where they can offload, they can ask for advice, they can we can adopt a coaching model where we talk them and support them and question them to coming up with their own solutions. I think that space is really important. And it would be a fantastic study to see if it helps with attrition within school contexts or indeed on teacher education. So the impact of people. And you and I were talking before we started recording about where is there space within, and this, we were talking particularly around teacher education programs, linking to some education support data around how well student teachers feel prepared to look after their own well-being and also the well-being of the pupils. You can apply this to development in schools as well. Where does the development or around well-being, resilience, mental health, self-care sit within the CPD offer of a school or in the curriculum in initial teacher education? And would there be benefit for prioritising this more? I'm not saying over other things, but making it a much more dominant feature of these programmes.
I absolutely agree with that. I think that in lots of schools, well-being is a cake on the table on a Friday in the staff room. But I think well-being is much deeper than that. I think we need to recognise it rather than pretending it's not there. I think we need to face up to the challenges of teachers. The book was particularly written around trying to get a staff meeting to be started by having a conversation, or a conversation started by the by a chapter around well-being. So we all can feel comfortable that we're all feeling this, because it's a common human thing. And then we can put the input in, whatever it is, semicolons or fronted adverbials or math mastery. But until we've had that moment to just calm ourselves and relax ourselves and get ourselves into the space of wanting to receive knowledge, I think we're always going to be pushing against the tide.
Mm. Yeah. And again, it's like development for teachers when they say, oh, I'd love to attend X on wellbeing or self-care, I just don't have the time. And that's, there's an irony in there, isn't there? That actually they need to make the time, but they don't feel they can. So how can we really work with those people and indeed ourselves? Because there's always someone who's, you feel, or who do they get their advice from? Kind of to make sure these people are engaging with things like this and prioritising them.
I think what I tried to do the other day or last week when I was talking to a group of students is, you can have a lovely plan and it can be beautifully articulated on paper, but if you're exhausted, that lesson's going to be rubbish. They're not going to engage the students. The students aren't going to want to learn, but it looks beautiful on paper. Part of preparing for a lesson is preparing yourself emotionally for the challenge of being in that classroom. The teacher standard one is about inspiring and motivating. Well, we can't inspire and motivate if we haven't got the energy to do that. So I was presenting in front of them, or hopefully inspirational and hopefully motivational. And I talked to them about the fact that I prepared to do that. And it wasn't about doing another 45 slides on my PowerPoint. It was about preparing myself in order to deliver the lesson that I believed was needed to convince them to look after themselves. And actually, it hit a note. And actually, quite a few of them said, actually, yeah, I get it. Part of lesson preparation is preparing me.
Yeah, absolutely. So without then dwelling, because like I said, I'm very conscious of not wanting to put a negative spin on everything. There are people that seem to manage and that do manage to have a hugely positive career, whereby over a long period of time, teaching, in leadership, in education, or whatever role they have, they've been in education a long time, and they manage to maintain their motivation and drive still. What do you think is their secret?
I don't think it's particularly a secret. I think it's adaptability. So I think it's very much bending your knees. So when I went skiing once, and that was ample for me, and the one thing I came back from remembering about my skiing trip was bend your knees, David. Whatever you do, bend your knees. That's all I remember. I think it's a useful phrase. I think we need to bend our knees. I think we need to go with the flow, and we need to go over the bumps when they come. We need to be looking to see when the bumps are coming so that we don't get caught out, because I think we're looking straight down at our feet and not a little bit further ahead to see what's coming. And then we hit it, and then that can make us feel dreadful when we do that. So I think people who are succeeding have the ability to get their head above the parapet and have a good look around. I think they have a sense of it's a job, not a lifestyle. So I think they're able to have that, okay, it's pressurized, but it's just a job. And they have that kind of reality check.
Mm-hmm.
I think we think that we're a little bit more influential than we are on learning. And actually, we're not as influential as we think we might be. And so I think having that kind of authentic reality check with folk is important. And then the third one is follow your dreams and be the teacher you want to be. You can still be that. And I get very frustrated with colleagues that say that they don't have autonomy or they don't have choice or they don't have the way of teaching. You can and you should. You should teach in the way that you want to teach and you teach in the way that you can teach. I teach history at the university or teach teachers how to teach history. And it's very much, there's huge amounts of flexibility within the history curriculum. It talks about curiosity as a teaching point. And curiosity is a wonderful thing. Ask why, ask how. And you can teach any subject once you get to that ability to ask questions and not worry about whether you know the answers or not, just have a desire to want to find out. And I think that having that excitement of learning is something that I've got and I never lose. And that's why I'm in my 26th year of teaching.
And I think as well, there is an element of getting to know yourself, which sounds a bit bizarre because you think, well, I am myself, so I must know myself. And actually, I don't know that. Maybe we do know ourselves, but it's acknowledging that we know ourselves and getting to very much in tune with how we're responding to a situation with regards to, we'll revert to type. If we're stressed or overworked or we've got something coming up, we tend to revert to type. And I think for me, getting to know oneself and little ways that we react to things that aren't always positive and embracing that and realizing that you're reacting in that way, it doesn't necessarily stop you doing that, but at least you're aware that you're doing it and why is a huge help. But I think all the time we've got this kind of strive to cover over and cover it up. Was listening to a podcast earlier about perfectionism is a massive barrier to success. And yet I think we're stuck all the time in trying to put this perfectionism or polish our perfectionism crown, if you like. And actually we need to get to know ourselves and how we are. What are our weaknesses? Where don't we perform so well? What causes us stress? What do you think about that kind of thing?
I completely agree that perfectionism is not attainable in teaching. And that's why it's a depreciative model that we can't meet. Because there's 30 randomizers in every classroom. Therefore, why are we predicting the outcome? Why do we even assume that we can predict the outcome? Why are we trying to predict that? And why are we chastising ourselves when we can't predict that outcome? That's like asking you what the weather's going to be like on October the 7th in 2023. You can have a go, you might be right, but the likelihood is you're going to get it wrong. And I think that there's this idea of perfectionism in teaching is not realistic. It's not reality and it's not authentic. So I think there's a disconnect again between the two positions. The way I see it is acknowledge wherever you are and then how can you be one more? Mm-hmm. Because that's not a deficit model. That's a model of forward momentum, which is a lot to do about resilience and well-being. So if I take a session at uni and I will say, okay, it was a 7, how could it be an 8? Not, oh, woe is me, I didn't predict that, you know, so-and-so wasn't going to turn up and, you know, the windows were going to be open and that was going to make the classroom cold and all of these things. But it's a 7. What could I have done to make it an 8? Done. Move on. You know, it happened. It's real. Move on. So I think one more is a really, really important mental conversation that I have with myself. And I think perfectionism goes back to this idea of we're all superheroes. And I hate that phrase. And I hear lots of people talking about, let's be superheroes. Let's tell the children to be superheroes. But we're not. We're We're human beings, and we're imperfect and vulnerable as a result of that. And I think we do need to learn ourselves. We do need to learn more about ourselves. I've learned much more about myself in the last 5 years. I've learned how my brain works as a human being. I've learned how to reassure myself when I'm feeling vulnerable. I've learned how to motivate myself when I'm not motivated. Mm-hmm. These are all unique to me. And I can share ideas with colleagues, but they've got to learn for themselves what makes them tick, what makes them work, what tops them up nice and quickly. So I do completely agree with you that we've got to learn who we are and how we work.
Yeah.
And that's not in a kind of neuroscience-y kind of way, and you get overly intellectualized about it. I just think you need to reflect back on how did you react to that, or why did you react to that? And most of the time is you react poorly to situations when you haven't looked after yourself, mm-hmm. when you're tired, when you're hungry. These are the times when we don't react very well to the situation. It's an inauthentic response. It's a reaction and not a response. And there's a difference between those two. A reaction is a need, like a knee-jerk reaction. It's an immediate one. But that's when our animal brain is taking over. And that's our animal brain that's kind of irrationally responding. But a response, a human response, is a 90-second gap between thinking about it and making a decision. But we don't give ourselves that time to think those things through and get our human brain in action before we make those decisions. But I think we need less superheroes and more authentic human beings in school.
Yeah, I completely agree. I really like two things you said. So firstly, you said get to know yourself, which is and how we work, which was how I was stumbling through earlier on, and you've said it much more concisely and eloquently than I. So get to know yourself and how you work. That's so important. But then I love the idea of that one, because we can come out of days, events, teaching sessions, lessons, meetings, whatever, and be really hard on ourselves because it didn't go well. And sometimes it's our perception it didn't go well. And sometimes truly it hasn't gone well. We haven't put our best selves forward. We hadn't prepared enough. And we can get really down about that. But I really like the way of going, accepting, yeah, what, it was a 7. It might have been a 5 even. But what would I do to make it a 6 or an 8? Just adding that one on, I think, is realistic, rather than saying, why wasn't I perfect?
Yeah. So the one more can be also, what do I need? So if I had a bad lesson, I need a cup of coffee, I need a bar of chocolate, I need to go and see the person who thinks I'm the best thing since sliced bread, because I need to get myself back up to +6, at least +6, in order to be ready for the next lesson or the next challenge or the next thing. I did an NAHT webinar and we talked about the 50-minute hour and using just 10 minutes to just check in on yourself and think about yourself and to consider how things are going, how your day's gone. And I think that could be a useful strategy for people to think, okay, where am I? And how can I be one more?
Yeah, that's another great idea. The 50-minute hour, I like that as well. And they're going back to that podcast I was listening to about the being perfect. Actually, what perfectionism stops you from doing is seeking support and help. So if you're striving for perfection, you don't ever ask for help, because it's seen as weakness. You're not accepting your imperfections. And then, of course, we can all see where that goes. You know, you're not asking for help and it gets into a difficult place. So lastly, and there's so much I know to talk about, but we are still in the pandemic. And when we've spoken over the past, getting on for 2 years now, we keep talking about when we're not, we still are. And post-COVID though, hopefully looking positively to a new horizon, a lot of people are reassessing their circumstances, or throughout COVID, lots of people have reassessed their circumstances, including their career and their well-being and what they want from life actually. What would be your advice to teachers who are really going through this process and wondering, I love teaching, but actually it affects my well-being negatively. Are there any pieces of advice where we can ask teachers who have been under immense pressure through this pandemic, not only with cases in school, but online teaching and so on and so forth, and working throughout? What would be your advice?
Well, firstly, I don't think that COVID is over, and I think we're still in a very difficult place in schools right now. And I think that we need to be doing more of reassuring ourselves that we're going to get to a place of psychological safety. And by that, I mean, we've got to calm our minds so that our minds are ready to teach. So when I go to university, I have to talk to myself and reassure myself that the space that I find myself in and the people that I'm with, I feel safe and comfortable as much as I can be in that scenario. And I work hard on that. I make sure that I get that so that I can feel reassured. And if I can't get that, then I might move them to a bigger room, or I might ask them to put a mask on, or I might open another window. But I think, firstly, we need to find that. Secondly, I think a decision now is not what is needed. So I don't think we're a decision-making process, because this is like a reaction and not a response. A considered response is, and I talked about this in risk, risks are only risks if we haven't thought about it. Mm-hmm. If we haven't looked after our resilience and we just dive in and just do something stupid, we'll always live to regret that. But when we look after ourselves, and we're in a good psychological place, and we keep coming back to it, and we keep saying, it's not right, there's something not right, then that's the point where we then have that internal narrative starting to form. And by that I mean, okay, I came in thinking that teaching was this, and actually teaching is this, going back to the first question. There's an inauthentic nature about what I'm doing. This is the narrative that you can tell yourself. And then you need to tell someone else, a trusted person, before you do anything, nothing to do with the job, nothing, no, away from the situation, away from the job. You've got to tell a trusted other. So that narrative that's in your mind is externalized, and that narrative is shared. And in articulating that narrative, you can start to consider whether it seemed real, whether it seemed authentic. How did they react to it? How did you react to their reaction? And if you still feel comfortable at that point, that actually, yes, there is a potential plan to go forwards, then you can start thinking about, okay, so what are we going to do about it? What's the course of action? What's the process? So I left headship going through that model, because it felt to me that there was something else out there. I have my internal narrative. I made that external. I told loved ones and important people. I put a plan around it. It still felt fine. I still did it. And now look at me. I'm happy as Larry, and I'm doing some authentic things that make me happy. During COVID, post-COVID, pre-COVID, I'm dealing with it because I've made the right decision.
And that's a really nice anecdote, really, your personal anecdote about your career shift to end on. And within there, I think one of the most important things you said is to talk to trusted others and explore. Not everyone finds that easy, but I think as well to talk to trusted others who are going to give you an honest response. And that's sometimes harder, because sometimes when we're not feeling great about a situation, or we feel our resilience is a little bit low, sometimes we do lean upon the people that are going to tell us what we want to hear, not what necessarily we need to hear. So having that, those supporters around you, but is really important, but you need to have those people who will be honest with you, both good and, you know, not so good. Sometimes people will tell you what you don't want to hear and reground you. And I think that's important. And they're not doing it out of any malice, but I think those people are so important to have around us. I know I have a mentor, if you like, who will do exactly that. And they're great. And I go to them and I'm sharing, I'm open, but they will be the first people that to say, hey, come on, and put me back in my place. You know, not if my aspirations get too big or anything in that way, but sometimes saying, come on, you might think that, but you know that not to be true, or come on, I don't think. And that having those like come on moments and the honesty is really, really important.
I think you need that authentic person at the other side of that to hear the narrative. But I think there's also, regardless of who's listening to the narrative, externalizing that story is going to give it its first exposure in the big wide world and out of your head. And in the terms of articulating that, can massively make a difference to how you think about it. But we can share it with a challenge, a person who's going to be challenging that friendly challenge. But we can also air it to the person who thinks we're brilliant and we're going to just go, yeah, 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 whatever. But you've got to recognize it is the person that goes, yeah, 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 whatever. So it's not really a good airing of your story. So we need to find a range of people before we make any decision. And I went through my process and I spoke to at least six different people, all who played different roles. As I got more confident and stronger with the conversation, the narrative that was forming, I chose trickier people along the way as my strength grew until the point I got to the chair of governors and told them. And then they panicked.
As chairs of governors, as I know, being one, do tend to do when things like you get thrown a curveball. But I think as well, as part of that conversation, we've veered off, but I think this applies to if you're going for a promotion, if you're thinking about leaving your current job to take another job elsewhere. Sometimes we do that when our resilience is low as well, because we think it will be the grass is greener kind of phenomenon. So you have a bad week or you're tired, a few bad lessons, and you think, I'm going to go somewhere else because it will be better. And it's these people that say, actually, because they're not emotionally involved. And I think talking to people that have no emotional connection or investment in your decision is also really important, because they can say, well, actually, look, what will it bring you, and ask you those difficult questions. But also they don't have that vested interest. So if you spoke to your head and you're a really fantastic teacher, they will be kind of have a vested interest to keep you. If you're being headhunted by another school because you know them, they'll have a vested interest to get you to go. So, and then maybe your partner will have a vested interest because the new school is further away and that will add impact on their life. You know, it's really who we talk to is so important, because they will have some kind of interest. So talking to someone completely impartial is often good.
We've got to find our rational response. And the way to find that rational response is finding other people that can help us to find that, recognizing when we've got an emotional connection to it, recognizing any bias that might come from, as people, as you say, the head teacher or the next school trying to smooth you over or get you to say yes or get you to say no. But I think once we've found our authentic response, we're calm, we've built our resilience, we know it's right, then when you make that decision, it feels really authentic, and then you just move on with it. I think that's the way to do it.
Well, thank you so much, David, for your insights. It's been a fascinating chat, and I could sit and chat for absolutely hours with you about this. I think it's such an important topic, but thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure, and I hope there's something that I've spoken about that will resonate with listeners and able to move them on or move them one more than wherever they were when they first listened to this podcast.
I'm sure it will. It certainly has for me.